and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is July 13th, 2022. And this is episode 338. You're listening to Radio Warner. I'm Mark Ames, the co-host. You should be getting us through patreon.com/Radio Warner. And I am on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. The Warnerd, in Greenpoint Telescope Audio Studios with Brendan. John, you can hear me all right?
I can hear you, yeah.
Oh, good.
I'm getting, you know, when I was young, I read a lot of Donald Westlake novels. They're kind of caper novels, and they're all set in New York City, and they have one character who's always talking about the route he took to get to their meetings, and he can't shut up about it. I'm really starting to understand this, trying to get from West 108th Street in the Upper West Side of Manhattan to Telescope Audio here in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. It's like...
Did you subway it?
I have on occasion, but I don't want to do that before a show because it really wears you out, especially in midsummer. I got a car today, and it was not only really expensive, but I found myself almost wanting to tell the driver to try a different route or something.
Yes, yes.
And I don't want to do that because I'm not up to that. I mean, I remember when you were working for a billionaire and you were in a real yelly mood. You had got into a big fight with a taxi driver coming back from the airport in Kuala Lumpur to town.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just cowering in the corner.
Yeah. That rich guy taught me to yell at to get your way done. It was, you know, I have to say, I miss it. I became a coward again after a while. But he yelled at me so much that I yelled at everybody else. It was very Smithers-esque. You know, it was like yelling from one way to the other. And so, I had that skill for a while. And people respect it.
Absolutely. I never said it didn't work, just that it was a little scary.
Yeah. I used to go crazy. That's why I used to just hate taking taxis, Ubers, whatever the hell, in New York City. Just, you remember before the show, we had to go like 1 mile and it took us 25 minutes.
Yeah. Because there was some kind of official vehicle just there for good.
That's all it takes. That's all it takes. So, right. So today we're going to talk about, have a great interview with a friend of the show, Ben Aris, of BNE IntelliNews, about the economic war and Russia, Ukraine, and Europe. But before that, I think now's that time of the month to sort of go over a little bit of the world of wars in the news. So I thought maybe you could sort of update us on Ethiopia and Tigray. I noticed. I was very sort of, I don't know, pleased to hear it, that there is a lot of interest from subscribers in what's going on in Ethiopia and Tigray. And in particular, in the way you have understood it, you in particular, because not a lot of people sort of, at least in our podcast world or whatever, have seen war quite the way you have. But it turns out a lot of people interested in that region I really appreciate it. So I think let's get an update on what's going on there.
Okay. Yeah. It's been a while since we went into Tigray on the show. And like you say, it's been really heartening to see that a lot of people do care about what's going on there. I mean, the major media don't, but other people do. And even in that, I have to say, there's a real difference. Al Jazeera tries. They think of Tigray as a real place, at least, and they've been trying to follow it. Doesn't mean they're always right, but at least they know it exists. So the main thing is in Tigray and in Ethiopia right now is that the truce is holding, which is a really pleasant surprise. It's not an entirely pleasant surprise, but for reasons I'll get into, but it's obviously better than continued slaughter because this is... Mm-hmm. become, unlike some of the Eritrean-Ethiopian wars of the last century, some of them. Unlike those, this has really degenerated into massacre and counter-massacre in a lot of places, but doesn't mean it's equal either. One side has a preponderance of power to do massacres. So the truce holding means that the TDF or TPLF controls Tigray, and the Ethiopian government is officially allowing aid and especially medicines to come into Tigray. Mm. Medicines are particularly important. When we talked to those demonstrators, Catherine and I went to see in Toronto months ago, they said what really hurts Tigray is that you can't get medicines because there's a lot of endemic disease there. It's a very poor region. No medicine means that sort of tragedy you see in Yemen where people end up dying of perfectly curable or preventable diseases.
Right.
And Tigray, as we've said a billion times, is particularly susceptible to that because it's a landlocked province. And it's sandwiched between Eritrea and Ethiopia, which, as is now clear, signed a secret pact leading to the Nobel Prize, to sandwich it between them. So particularly difficult to get any supplies. There are a couple of cautions to the good news angle, though. One, the more simple one, Western Tigray, which is the flat part, has been occupied by Ethiopia, which claims it as traditional Amhara territory rather than Tigrayan. It's able to do that because Western Tigray is mostly flat and the armor-heavy Ethiopian and Eritrean forces had an advantage from the beginning there. It wasn't as easy to reconquer as the more mountainous eastern parts of Tigray. If you want to look Tigray up, a lot of people already know this, but if you don't, it's shaped like a sort of crumpled boot pointing down, with the toe pointing down. And what's happened is the top of the boot leg is Western Tigray then. So that is now firmly in Ethiopian state hands. And the Ethiopian government controls that. The Eritrean government controls a strip of the Tigrayan-Ethiopian border, very much around the area that was fought about in the Millennial War between Eritrea and Tigray. And I'm not quite sure what the status of Eritrean troops in Western Tigray, which is officially controlled by the Ethiopian government, is. They're more to be feared so far in the war. They're more reckless about their atrocities. Though the Ethiopian government in Western Tigray also has Amhara militia.
Where they are, doing the dirty work stuff.
Right, And so what this means is for the central government, which had a real problem with the Tigrayan elite, which had, as they saw it, wormed its way into control of all sorts of business and government enterprises, what this means is Tigrayans who fled to Tigray are more or less safe right now, assuming they can get medicine, assuming they can buy food and all that. But those in the rest of Ethiopia are vulnerable, to put it mildly. And there are continuous reports of arrests, purges, killings of Tigrayans, even in the streets of the capital, Addis Ababa. And this is one of the reasons that this truce might have been a good thing for the Ethiopian government, as well as the Tigrayan people, who are probably getting some food and medicine now. But it means that the Tigrayans who try to retain their position in the capital, in the state itself, in the seat of power, can be got rid of or leveraged out or convinced to flee, which are all traditional ways of dealing with troublesome minority populations. It isn't all good news. There's clearly big purges going on, and not much being reported either. Along with that, there's the other shoe that everybody's waiting to hear drop, the Oromo shoe, as it were. You got the Tigrayan boot and the Oromo shoe. Oh, suave. I'm a you know natural born radio guy. Okay, so the Oromo are the biggest ethnic group in Ethiopia, traditionally classed as somehow less than the dominant Amhara and Tigrayan ethnic groups from the highlands to the north. But increasingly, they want a share of power. Abiy Ahmed, the current president, got a lot of Oromo votes because he is either entirely Oromo or half Oromo, half Amhara, depending on whose story you get. But when the Tigrayans had reconquered their territory, they continued pushing south in a really remarkable sudden offensive using a lot of captured vehicles to within a short distance of Addis Ababa itself. And that sparked an Oromo rebellion. It's not clear how much power that Oromo rebellion really has militarily, but it is clear it has a lot of sympathy with the Oromo population of Ethiopia. So right now, the only areas that are still under the control of the Oromo Liberation Army are in the far west of Oromia, near the Kenyan border and on the road to the Kenyan border, south of the Sudan border, if you want to see it on the map. Mm-hmm. Just little pockets there. But there have been supposedly attacks on Amhara settlers who've moved recently to traditionally Oromo areas. And that's probably what this war will look like as it devolves into a series of local ethnic land wars. Everybody is going to be a lot more nervous. Oromo, Amhara, Tigrayan, mm-hmm. and smaller ethnic groups, too. There are a lot of ethnic groups in mm-hmm. Ethiopia. It is, as we've said before, an empire. And probably the most at risk are the smaller ethnic groups near one of the big ethnic groups. And so this is going to continue dissolving for a while. It's like a slow solvent now. It doesn't really seem like the Abiy Ahmed government has the power to re-coalesce its empire at the moment. It may do so, but if it does, it'll be a bloody effort. And if it can't, that will be bloody too. So it's mm-hmm. kind of bad news.
Yeah, just a couple stats here. I'm seeing in a WAPO, reprint, I think, of this AP article. The total population, 115 million, second most populous in Africa after Nigeria. 90 different ethnic groups, mm-hmm. according to Ethiopians. And the Oromo would be the largest at 34%, and then the Amhara at 27%. But what you're describing also with Tigray, it reminds me of what somebody from the Radio Warner Facebook page, who I believe is from the area, had said when this was, he sort of predicted this 6, 7, 8 months ago when the Tigrayan forces, the TPLF, were being pushed back. He said basically Tigray is going to be turned into Ethiopia's Gaza Strip.
Mm.
And I've just kind of held on to that thought ever since because it was a very grim and it seems to be so far fairly accurate. Like they're going to kind of keep it bottled up, yeah. keep it poor, but at least if the aid and the medicines are getting through, I mean, at least they're not being completely genocided the way things were going earlier. So
yeah, that's true. That's a lot better than being completely wiped out. Yeah, it might, like I said, it might be more to the interests of the governing elite in the capital to get rid of the people in the capital who probably have risen to powerful positions.
Right.
The Tigrayans can have Tigray, especially because it, as I said, it's a totally isolated place, sandwiched mm-hmm. between Eritrea, which is violently hostile to it in spite of the fact mm-hmm. that it's, you know, ethnically very closely related, and Ethiopia. the question of what's going to happen with Oromia is really interesting right now. I mean, it takes a while to develop the discipline and the organization to have a really good guerrilla movement like the TPLF, or as it's rebranded, the TDF. You don't come up with one of those overnight. And the Oromo nationalist movement has split many times over all kinds of things, the way movements usually do, moderates and radicals, armed force and political means, strategy, ideological loyalties to one figure or another. And there's a lot of risk that it will just end up being mutual ethnic cleansing without a clear leadership by whichever group has more weapons and more men, because it will be mostly men, at a given location. There have been a lot of massacres of Amhara settlers in western Oromia, which is where the OLA and OLF still have their few holdouts. And even in the capital, there have been demonstrations by Amhara students saying, "Stop massacring us." And counter-demonstrations by Oromo, like, you know, "We're the ones being massacred." And security forces have been firing pretty promiscuously into all of those demonstrations. So it's looking like a dissolving world.
God. Yeah. It's just going to be so bloody if it, well, I mean, if it's brought under control, it's going to only be brought under control most likely through really bloody means too. But no matter what, as you said, we're looking at a lot of bloodshed here. Abiy just a couple of days ago said that Ethiopian police and soldiers are dying on a, quote, daily basis doing counterinsurgency in Oromia.
Yeah.
So this is a very hot insurgency. I mean, this isn't like a low-level, just beginning kind of insurgency. This is extremely active.
And apparently not too disciplined either, more like an ad hoc thing, like, you know, get some weapons and go get those people. And those are really dangerous because there's no one really in charge.
Okay, so we're going to keep an eye on that. Still, hopefully, you know, we're still out searching for a good guest on this too. Anybody has any suggestions? And we've tried. There aren't many people to, you know, it's hard to find somebody to talk about Ethiopia, particularly somebody, you know, who can be sort of as objective as possible.
If you've ever looked at Ethiopian versus Tigrayan versus Eritrean Twitter, it's one of the most brutal Twitter exchanges you'll ever see.
Yeah, it's like soccer fans. You know, I mean, it's kind of All right, so let's see what else is going on here. I think. Real quickly, that story came out in the BBC. I don't know if you saw this, where it's been revealed that the SAS tortured a bunch of Afghan detainees, and they're just sort of, I think there was a BBC or Panorama investigation where they found something like, I think, 54 Afghan detainees who were unlawfully, or whatever you call it, you know, just murdered, let's say, tortured and murdered. And they had weapons planted on them to justify the murder. I mean, I don't mean to be jaded here, but, like, you know, we just did part one of our Cyprus episode. Like, this is what they've done. Yeah. They've been unaccountable for this, as with the Americans and everybody else in the glorious Western world. I mean, there's no accountability for it. And this is just standard operating procedure.
It's really delicate ground here because I don't want to say all counterinsurgencies are exactly alike, but roughly this is part of counterinsurgency, and it happens generally. That doesn't mean I'm trying to excuse it here, but I mean, maybe when you start a counterinsurgency mission, just keep in mind it's going to degenerate into something like this.
Yeah, and that's what's annoying. It's like, well, how could they have known when they first went into Afghanistan that it would degenerate into this? Well, open up any history book and not like, you know, the comic books and the children's history books that you people like reading and telling to each other, I guess, to maintain the faith. I mean, that reminds me, so I was listening, once in a while, I listened to this I listened to a few minutes anyway of a, I think it was from the U.S. Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. It's called Spycast, and they have spies on, retired spies to come on and, you know, and talk about their experiences and sometimes talk about what's going on today. And it's very disappointing. I mean, I'll be honest, I always kind of hope it'll be a lot more interesting, a lot more revealing, a lot weirder and darker and stuff. And for the most part, it's really unlistenable. It's almost indistinguishable from like the Tom Clancy version, but this is with the actual, you know, top retired officers. So this is how they talk to each other. So I was just listening to this guy who was like a very senior, he was on recently, he was a very senior counterintelligence guy who worked in Moscow. He worked in some other hot theaters going back, I think he first joined in the 70s. And the way he talked about Putin and Russia, it was so, like, you know, sometimes we wonder where do guys like David Brooks and Thomas Friedman, where do they get these, like, this sort of Sunday school voice from? But this is exactly how this guy was talking. He's like, Vladimir Putin is a monster. And he doesn't adhere to our, you know, our ways. And the CIA, we never do this kind of stuff. He's a monster. He's barbaric and blah, blah, blah. And he was going on. And, you know, but of course, this is nothing against the Russian people. They're a long-suffering, decent people. They're just not allowed to be free. Like, it's just one homily after another, one cliche after another. And this was like a top counterintelligence guy.
Yeah.
And I don't think he was putting on a show for the pie. He's retired. He's old. I think this is how they talk to each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's really annoying. It's infuriating.
It's wild. I mean, we both saw one of the most bizarre articles you could hope to find in,
yes.
You know, there are now these programs that can generate like NYT PitchBot, and they generate articles like these, but it's really hard to keep ahead of the true bizarreness of actual articles. So this is another NPR article that I came across called How Russia's Current War in Ukraine Echoes Its Crimean War of the 1850s. It's by somebody called Greg Meyer, or the aptly named Greg Meyer, as we say. And the lack of historical insight in this supposedly historically based article is stunning.
It's so funny, isn't it? I mean, it's not funny.
Yeah.
It's just so freaking ridiculous is what it is.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you're talking to maybe a younger lefty audience, they are aware that something called the British Empire existed and did bad things. But among the DC security correspondent crowd, like this guy, they haven't quite figured that out yet. So this is a quote about from that article. During the Crimean War, 1850s, The Economist magazine, Dash, the same one that's still going strong, Dash, wrote a scathing piece in 1854 on Russia and its leader, Tsar Nicholas I. Quote, that vast state is in great measure composed of spoils which she has torn from surrounding nations. Her frontier provinces are filled with injured, discontented, hostile populations, many of whom wait with patience and desire the blessed day of emancipation and revenge. End quote. And then this silly NPR stooge adds his own comment, sounds a lot like Ukraine today.
I mean, where do you even begin at this point? This is like literally within 5 years on either side of this, The Economist was cheerleading the genocide through famine of Irish, was promoting, the imperial wars everywhere, the opium wars. Like the exterminations of tens of millions of people. But this is the thing, you know, where you read this piece or this excerpt of The Economist, that righteous, moral, righteous indignation is I don't know how to say it. It's authentic in some weird way. That's the part that always stuns me.
In fact, it's genetic, apparently.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, no matter what you say about, the Russian people, I'm not talking about the Russian people. Usually when somebody says that, yes, you are.
Exactly. Yeah. Always beware when you hear somebody say that, you know. But it's so funny because there's so many problems with that. I mean, actually, I think the analogy, it's not a bad idea. I think we've even mentioned there are some echoes here and there of it. But if you're really sticking with this analogy, then in this analogy, Ukraine is the Ottoman Empire. Because that's who the West with the Ottomans came into. Basically, what did they want to do? They wanted to weaken Russia.
Yeah.
And there was this hysterical anti-Russian lobby instrumentalizing Polish emigres. We did a whole episode on
this. And it was absolutely not motivated by any love for the Ottoman Empire. It was just a useful tool and one that was weakening and that raised, or at least pretended to raise, for defense lobbyists in Britain, the specter of Russian domination of Istanbul. And that made it profitable to support the Ottoman Empire against Russia. And, you know, there are a lot of dead Armenians who might ask whether that was such a good idea, because a lot of them still look to Russia as their only protectors. But that really didn't figure in strategic thinking as it is and was called.
Yeah. Anyway, that's Greg Meyer. I looked him up in his wiki page, and I'll bet you he or his flunky put this in. He studied at Yale, where he was on the varsity football and basketball teams.
Well, that qualifies.
He's a winner.
Yeah,
I know.
Nothing
a true
else
winner.
Does.
Yeah, I'll bet you, I mean, a guy like that reads The Economist and thinks, you know, every time I read that magazine, I feel a little bit smarter every day.
Yeah.
Says those people. Anyway.
God damn, you're suave.
Right. So moving on to Russia now from there. Really briefly with the war, we're not going to do much of an update on the war. I mean, there's so much out there. But just, I guess the only thing we can say in general, larger terms, the big stories were really that Russia had took all of Luhansk province. That was already a couple of weeks ago, I think, at this point. What was, I think, surprising was how quickly Lysychansk fell. It was Severodonetsk. These were two medium-sized, 100,000-plus cities next to each other. Really one city divided up into two, and Lysychansk geographically should have been the harder one to take. And there is, anyway, we'll just keep an eye on it because the way Lysychansk fell quickly, I mean, the Ukrainians surprised everyone by doing it was a strategic withdrawal, but that's not how that hasn't been their strategy so far. And there have been more reports than normal coming out about morale problems, troop level problems that you haven't really seen leak. I mean, we started to see some of that coming out before the Severodonetsk, before Russia took Severodonetsk. But in the time since, you started to see a few articles even talking about questioning how long Ukraine can really go on.
Yeah, there was clearly a disjunction in the official media coverage, and you really can't call it anything else, because Lysychansk was being built up for weeks as the city on the heights. This
exactly.
is not like Severodonetsk, which is on the flat and easy to roll over. This is on the heights, and it will put up one heck of a fight.
And Zelensky went there personally,
right?
Into Lysychansk, not Severodonetsk, but Lysychansk to shore up morale. And then,
And then it sort of didn't get mentioned much. It just fell, and then there was another story to move on to. I think it's really worth remembering that excellent interview we had with Seth Harp, who talked about going to the official media center in Kyiv and getting the story of the day. Not that all those stories are false, but there is generally a story of the day to follow. And Lysychansk stopped being that story when it fell.
Mm-hmm. One of the more surprising stories to come out in the last sort of week or so out of the New York Times. I mean, again, I think you have to read our official press kind of like old Kremlinology, right? Like what's leaking through. And also because the Ukrainians really do tightly control and they don't need to put a gun to any Western journalist's head because the Western journalists are at least as gung-ho as their Ukrainian minders are. But they are sort of controlling access, where you can go, where you can't go, and controlling narratives with, we're sure, Western, you know, advisors, media advisors. And one story that really surprised me in the New York Times, I think Carlotta Gall was one of the authors of it, was a story that admitted, I hadn't seen this in the Western press admitted from since well before even the invasion, that a lot of you citizens of these towns that are now in the front lines, really like even, you know, Slavyansk and Bakhmut and Kramatorsk and other ones that are in the Donetsk region, that no one's really sure where their loyalties lie. And it's clear that there are, for a lot of the people who live there, they just want Russia to get it over with and take control. And they're not particularly loyal to Ukraine. And, you know, the ones who are very loyal to Ukraine, a lot of them have sort of left. And I don't know where you really go with that. So, I mean, first of all, I think it's true. Secondly, and I think loyalty is also sort of, it's a fickle thing. You know, there's going to be hardcore people on both sides, but there's also going to be a lot of people in this isn't, you know, America invading Iraq. This is people deeply intertwined for a very, very long time with a memory of it. And we're talking now the Russian speaking East.
Well, under those circumstances, it would be natural for most people to say, I would rather this house of mine, this apartment building of mine, didn't turn into a free fire zone. I would rather, you know, we just had this done.
Well, the surprising thing that this article sort of went out of its way to make the point was that it was more like, I want Russia here.
Right.
And I want Russia to... So, their loyalties are more with Russia than Ukraine, even after all this. And I have to admit, that surprised me a bit. Mm. I mean, one thing that surprised me, I want to keep an eye on this, is this is something I think I've gotten wrong, unless I'm missing something. There has not been the sort of insurgency behind the lines that I would have thought. Because it's clear there were a lot of people protesting in some of the cities they first took over, Melitopol and Kherson and some others. Like, people weren't happy to see the Russians come in. It was very bizarre at first, and there were some protests. And we haven't seen protests anymore, but we haven't, you know, an insurgency may yet develop, and certainly Ukrainian special forces will do their best, as anybody would, to force an insurgency, whether you like it or not. But I'm just kind of surprised by how little activity so far there has been behind the lines. From what I can tell, I don't know if you...
That's a good point. I mean, maybe because there is still a front line you can volunteer for, and that's drawing the people they might use for an insurgency. But they generally, if you're willing to die, you're more effective if you have some equipment as an insurgent than in the front lines. But, you know, maybe everybody who's willing to die is already on the front lines. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, something to keep an eye on. HIMARS are starting to be used. They're obviously more effective than other weapons of Ukraine's weapons. They're not a game changer, but they, you know, they're going to cause some more pain. Then I guess this one thing, we posted this on the Radio Warner Facebook page, but I saw this quote from this Robert Kagan, of all places, article in Foreign Affairs.
You got to tell people who Kagan is.
Right. So for those of you who don't know who Robert Kagan is, I mean, this is A-list neocon number one, big name behind the Project for a New American Century, the Iraq War, pretty much every war. Turned from Republican to Hillary, I think, in 2016. I mean, he would consider himself, I think, probably the thinking man's among the sort of pantheon of A-list neocons. He's like the thinking man's neocon. There's a whole family of them. First of all, his wife is Vicky Nuland, who's now the undersecretary of state, I believe, number four in the state, I think actually number one in the Foreign Service, number four for the State Department, but has she ran Ukraine policy under Obama, and she seems to pretty much run it under Biden as well. So that's his wife. You know, he's got, there's a Donald Kagan, there's a Fred Kagan. They're all neoconning their way around the Ivy Leagues and Washington, D.C. There's a Kimberly Kagan, I think her name is. I don't know if it's a daughter or a sister.
Not who runs a Kimberly. Okay.
Isn't that the name?
It could be. It's just like there's something weird about these names.
Yeah, I know. It is Kimberly Kagan. Yes. Yeah, it's pretty weird. She's married to Frederick Kagan. So she's nay something else. Kimberly Ellen Kagan. Right. And she has the Institute for the Study of War, which a lot of media has relied on, and they've been very unreliable, I should say. After the first couple of weeks, they were pretty reliable. But when things started to change, when like we were asking, and we, thank God we were able to find Seth Harp, like, why is nobody reporting the condition of the Ukrainian forces? And we started asking this like, you know, a month into the war. And it took a while. Like they were just reporting just rosy stuff until it was too embarrassing. And then they kind of had to change their tune a little bit. But it's somebody referred to them as the Kagan Industrial Complex.
Like, yeah, it's a great line.
It is a great line. I think I saw Scott Horton from antiwar.com referring to it as that. And they really are. I mean, they are a family dynasty embedded in the foreign policy elites. And so it is surprising and interesting. We have to do our old Kremlinology, I think, to sort of try and interpret it. I'll just read what I posted. And then this thing, I mean, I posted this on the Facebook page, which is true. I never quite know how to react when A-list neocons drop some sort of forbidden, at least in official discourse, truths, versions of truth. To me, it seems like a ruse or maybe an ethos credibility play, because it must get tiring repeating the same imperial rah-rah homilies as other tenured neocon idiots, you know, that you might snobbily consider your lessers. I'm not sure. I mean, there's that guy, Elliot Cohen, a true moron and just tenured for life because of it. I just had something in The Atlantic Monthly. Anyway, so here's what Kagan writes. It's his article called "The Price of Hegemony: Can America Learn to Use Its Power? Foreign Affairs May June Issue." And here's the excerpt from it. I think this was Peter Hitchens that quoted, had let this out. So Kagan writes, "Although it is obscene to blame the U.S. for Putin's inhumane attack on Ukraine, to insist that the invasion was entirely unprovoked is misleading.
Wow.
Russian decisions have been a response to the expanding post-Cold War hegemony of the U.S. and its allies in Europe. Putin alone is to blame for his actions, but the invasion of Ukraine is taking place in a historical and geopolitical context in which the U.S. has played and still plays the principal role." And it's bizarre because it's very sensible. I mean, you know, people seem to think you can't condemn Putin and admit to America's role and in provoking him, right? And it doesn't make it less stupid or criminal, but you know, we all agree the Versailles Treaty was stupid and made Germany a worse place. That doesn't mean Hitler had a right to gas 6 million Jews, but
one thing that strikes me is Kagan and his faction would above all want to remind people that America is still winning, you know, like the trend is still ours and we're part of this. But I think, there is also maybe that other point that somebody brings up in the excellent Facebook comments, which follow this, which is, it is an ethos move. Like, you know, I'm the boss here. I can say the things that if one of you rookies said it, you'd be blacklisted for life. But I can tell some truths here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of my sense as well. Kissinger came out. Now, Kissinger, people mistake it. I think the neocons were kind of born out of a split within the militarist imperial, you know, faction of D.C. The neocons, at least originally, are very anti-Kissinger. I mean, it's not as simple as that, but the idea was in the 70s that Kissinger, if you can believe it, was considered, I don't know, weak. And he sort of... he was willing to accept for the price of stability. He was a realist, right? I guess they would call it the realist. So he was brutal, but a realist whereas the neocons, their whole thing was boundless optimism about democracy promotion. That is to say about empire expansion and boundless optimism. But Kissinger, he's never going to die. I mean, he'll die long after we're all dead. But he recently came out and said something similar to this. So it's surprising to see Kagan from a different faction coming out and saying this. And you've seen little hints of this, like the New York Times had an editorial, you know, their diplomacy should be a part of this. Mm. Blinken, one of the statements Blinken said was, well, they've said this many times, this is, you know, whatever peace initiative, whether it's trading land or not, happens, it's up to Ukraine to decide that. And that can be interpreted two ways. One way is Ukraine's never going to go for that. And that means we're in it as long as Ukraine is in it, which is forever. Or another interpretation of it is we're no longer going to lean on, you know, we're no longer going to send Boris Johnson or whoever follows Boris Johnson. We're never going to send him out to Kyiv again anytime Kyiv is about to cut a ceasefire deal with Russia, because that's what Boris Johnson did twice. He went out, flew out there and told Zelensky, don't do it. We're going to make sure you win and just don't cut a peace deal. It's hard to say, but
I think it is astonishing that anyone believes Boris Johnson about anything. including whether he paid you that £1 for some chocolates. But to believe that from him, let you down.
I know. And the poor Ukraine, you're desperate in war. Poor suckers, like they've already named streets after Boris Johnson and are watching, you know, worried, I'd imagine, watching him go down because he positioned himself, in large part, I think, in order to try and distract from all the scandals he was up to his eyeballs in. He positioned himself as the Churchill of this economic war backing Ukraine.
He's Churchill again and again. I mean, that was his last defense. Stop it, I'm Churchill.
Yep. I know. It's pretty funny seeing him go. But it's like the Heathers. I mean, except the Heathers were at least kind of fun and in a horrible way. Just some ghoul, somebody even more ghoulish than he is going to come and probably not as funny.
Yeah.
And equally or worse, you know. That's the entropy of the world we live in, John. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think we can move on now to our interview. We have a great interview coming up with Ben Orris, the founding editor of BNE and Telenews on the economic war. And so we can catch up on the latest on that, because that is equally as important, at least, as the kinetic war.
Yeah, it's a great interview. He actually, you know, helped me understand some of the economic basis for what's going on.
Yeah. So let's get to our talk with Ben. Okay, so we are really excited to have back with us a friend of the show, Ben Orris. He is the founding editor of BNE and Telenews, and I'll post all the links to that, to his Twitter feed and to the site. He's been with us twice already on Radio Werner, just before the war started, shortly afterwards. And he's going to join us today to walk us through the latest in the economic war. So we should remind listeners or those who maybe haven't heard it yet that BNE and Telenews is a business, finance, and economics focus, right? We want you on because, well, I hate to say one war is more important and bigger than the other, but, in a lot of ways, the economic war sparked by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the economic war is truly global. And the one that I think we understand much less, but that is a much bigger, more consequential war with, potentially far worse fallout and stuff.
We should be clear. I mean, Putin crossing the border into Ukraine started a classic kinetic war, and that's contained within the Ukrainian borders. And moreover, NATO's been explicit the kinetic war is going to be contained inside the Ukrainian borders because NATO wants no part of that. You're talking about a third world war. But the West's response has been to launch an economic war, not that they're phrasing in those terms. And they're hitting Russia with everything they've got, bar the shells. And the consequences of that are going to be significant. I mean, they're going to be global. And we're already starting to see the repercussions of that. And it's going to get nasty and it's going to cause a lot of problems. And I think we've unleashed some tectonic forces that are going to screw with the global economy for years to come. And I'm not sure everyone's quite aware of what they've started. I don't think that the Western side has thought it through. They thought they could start this economic war and have no pain for themselves and crush Russia. And it's not looking like it's going to go that way.
Yep. Like, as in so many wars, when they start off, the plan looks exquisite, as they say. And the wars, the kinetic wars, that, you know, rarely go as the original planners meant them to go for all kinds of reasons, unforeseen reasons, and so on. And this happens, you know, 99% of wars. And this economic war is no different in that sense. I mean, there's so much. If you look back to the very beginning of it and the things being said that were going to happen from the economic war, I mean, it's causing Russia a lot of pain, but it's causing the home countries a lot of unforeseen pain and the developing world. I mean, it's, as you said, it's just sort of rearranging.
I was just thinking, I'm going to ask the naive questions because I don't understand economics. So, like, what were the sanctions meant to do?
The point of sanctions is a diplomatic tool, and the way they work is that you put them on, and the idea is to persuade or cajole another government to change its ways, to do something you want it to do or to stop doing something you don't want it to do. And traditionally, sanctions come with off-ramps in so much as, you know, you've got a goal, a specific goal, and that you say to the country is being sanctioned, if you do this, then we'll take that sanction off. If you do that, we'll take that sanction off. However, what's different this time round is the sanctions are just a flat-out weapon designed to inflict as much damage and pain on Russia as is possible. And that's new. I mean, that's war. The Russians are, you know, within their rights to say you've declared war on us, albeit in economic terms, that we can respond kinetically. And Russian has sort of keep hinting at that, but it hasn't come to that. But then maybe further in the conversation we can talk about this, but, you know, the threat of the use of nuclear weapons against Ukraine should Russia start to lose the kinetic war because of the economic war and the military support that NATO's giving to Ukraine is there in the background. And the Russians, Putin specifically, has made it clear that this is on the table, although he hasn't actually threatened to do it. And so in that sense, sanctions here are a weapon. And it's not being framed in that. But on, I forget when it was, February 28th, I mean, a few days after it started, that von der Leyen, the European Commission president, she came out and she said specifically, we're going to put the most extreme sanctions on Russia we can that are specifically designed to denigrate the economy and to crush the Russia machine. With a short-term goal of cutting it off from money so it can't pay for the war, and a long-term goal, I think, is just like to put it in the Trotsky dustbin of history is what the goal here is now. So this is real, you know, clash of the civilizations kind of confrontation that we've got into, which, you know, it's you could characterize it as a restart of the Cold War. So Cold War II. It's really monumental what's going on.
Yeah. This reminds me, I hadn't seen this reported much, but I have a journalist friend. A good friend I'm always in contact with. He's a journalist out in Europe and who knows German quite well. And he sent me some articles reminding what the Germans were saying also. Not the Germans, but the foreign minister in particular. And was it Annalena Baerbock, the foreign minister. This would also be like within the first few days. I mean, the translation is our sanctions will ruin Russia. Russia will not stand on her feet. That was after the first round. And then something along those lines. With the fourth or fifth package, here's another quote from her. Germany will contribute in the upcoming sixth sanctions package to damage Russia to such an extent that it won't be able to get back on its feet economically for years. And Lloyd Austin, the Pentagon chief, Biden's Pentagon chief, he also said that the goal is to weaken Russia to the point that it can basically that it can never threaten its neighbors again, which means significant weakening. So yeah, it's pretty serious stuff.
Well, I mean, listen to those quotes. I mean, they're not diplomacy. It's not diplomatic. Those are threats, flat out threats. You know, we are going to destroy you. So this is war. We're at war with Russia. It's just that nobody wants to cross the line and put NATO troops into Ukraine, because then you'd have a kinetic war, and you know, we'd have Russian missiles raining down on Dresden and Paris, and nobody's prepared to risk that.
If I can ask another naive question, I'm surprised to find the German government so ferocious. I thought there was a lot of push, especially from the US and the UK, the more ferocious powers traditionally, to make it contemporary Germany more ferocious, and they had a really hard time doing that because Germany has had some nasty experiences with war, and I thought they were always low.
Isn't it the Greens, though? Aren't they kind of unique in this? Or
And Baerbock's Green, actually, but she's come out very strongly, more strongly than Scholz, in support of Ukraine. And you know, the quote you just gave, I mean, she's gung-ho. She's like, we're going to destroy. Because there's a conflict here it's about values. I mean, this whole war is being framed as a clash of values of how you run your world, liberal democracy versus whatever Putin sees it, you know, Russian pride, the people, multipolar world, sovereign right to run your own country as you like, as he likes personally in his case, because the people don't get much of a say. And this is one of the reasons why it's become so polarized, and that the West has sort of nailed this flag to the flagstaff, and why it's being so adamant that Russia's crossed the line, it's gone beyond the pale, and so it must be destroyed, because it's shown itself as a partner that cannot be talked to, that cannot be trusted, and that the West offered, in their terms, so they think, to negotiate, to compromise with Russia. And that was the whole Merkel era. You know, she spent all that time with Putin, with the special relationship, saying, yeah, Russia's a bit prickly. Yes, it's very corrupt. Yes, it's a bit authoritarian. Yes, they just bombed the hell out of Grozny when they were fighting that war. But we can kind of live with that because we can do business and we'll bring them around in the long run. And at the same time, her and Schroeder before her have invested heavily into tying the German economy in particular to the Russian economy, hence its dependence on the gas. It's very heavy dependence, which has all gone horribly wrong now.
Yes.
And Germany, in that sense, has a very special relationship with Russia and a special role in this, and is in a particularly difficult position today because they did bet heavily. Or rather, they just assumed. I mean, this is the point I think most people made. I mean, Merkel's being slammed for her special relationship and for letting Germany become so dependent on Russian energy, gas in particular. However, if you look at the relationship, I mean, Russia's been selling gas to Europe and Germany in particular since the 70s. During the Cold War, when we were in ideological war with Russia,
right.
Soviet Union then, and no one had a problem with the energy relationship. So I think the bets of tying Russia, tying into the Russian energy thing, was absolutely sensible. If we could live through the Soviet period and still have reliable energy supplies from the Soviets, despite the ideological confrontation we had with them, surely with the new nominally democratic, nominally capitalist Russia, then that's a no-brainer. We can get our cheap gas. But now the war started, it's all gone wrong.
It's not just the like a kind of idealistic, starry-eyed, oh, we can work with Russians, they're humans like us. They got cheap gas, which fueled their export economy, right? I mean, there was their economy was kind of based on this relationship. Their powerful export-driven economy was based on getting cheap gas from Russia. So there was a big self-interest.
But this is one of the unintended consequences. Because I've been arguing that if you look at the sanctions regime and this economic war, up until the sixth package that came out in June, that was the first one that included coal, which was the first energy product to be sanctioned. And all the sanctions up until then have been what I've been calling one-way sanctions, that they inflict pain on Russia but do no damage to the West. And I believe, I don't know, but I believe that there's this underlying assumption that the West has that they can sanction Russia, punish its economy, without doing any harm to themselves. And now we're moving into the seventh package, and that's no longer true, because the oil sanctions, the gas sanctions, are now starting to cause significant economic pain and starting to pose real problems. And Germany is the case in point, because I think the Germans are starting to realize, they're waking up to the fact that if Russia cuts off the gas at the end of this month, which looks increasingly likely, then the German economic, well, the German economy is not only in crisis because they haven't got the fuel to heat themselves this winter, but actually the German economic model will be destroyed because it's based on this cheap gas that allows you to produce high-quality widgets very cheaply and export them all over the world. And the alarm bell went off last month where Germany, for the first time in 30 years since the 90s, ran a trade deficit. It was the first time that it happened that they actually lost money, German Inc., on their exports. They imported more than they exported. And this is one of the reasons why the Germans have been so freaked out by this whole war and so resistant to it. And the business lobby is leaning on Scholz really hard to say, stop this, we want a negotiated solution, we want to maintain some sort of gas imports. Because if you destroy Germany's economic model, then you take the motor out of the center of Europe. And the economic consequences of that for the whole of Europe will be enormous. That you'll just, I don't know, you know, the whole of Europe will run at half speed. And the politicians here, I think, are just starting to wake up to the fact that actually, not just a bit of pain and some extra money that we're going to have to spend, but our whole way of life may be altered, changed, that our whole business model that had been so successful for three decades might be wrecked, and we're going to have to find a new one.
This is so strange because I saw a headline today, for example, German Green Minister promises more coal. It's like, what?
They just announced they cut it off. They just announced August 1st today, just as before I came to this.
Oh, okay.
No more coal.
No, that they're cutting
August
off
1st.
Russian coal.
Russian coal.
Right?
But,
yeah,
but
Russian coal.
Yeah. But they're going to use, I don't know, they were going to use more.
Dig up their own coal or
yeah,
something. Or,
but yeah. The strangest
Polish.
Thing is I
Polish.
I don't understand this. How could, if you were part of the German elite, the German state, whatever you want to call it, how could this not, this result not have occurred to you?
Like I say, I think people have like been walking into this. It's all been a bit gung-ho. It's been very dramatic. And like we all three know well that the invasion came as a surprise.
Yeah.
And for the Germans in particular, that it just wasn't on the cards. It just wasn't considered as a possibility. I mean, the problems with Russia had led to Germany diversifying. Because again, everyone says that Germany and Europe is very dependent. But actually, again, in the 70s when the energy started, the Russia accounted for 70, 80% of the imports. And Germany and Europe as a whole have been busily diversifying to the point before the war, it was about 35%. It's up to 40 again now. But at the same time, the investment into the green energy. And Merkel said to Putin when she was in Moscow in September that, you know, within 20 years, we're not going to import any Russian gas. We won't need it anymore because the transition to green will be complete. And that will be totally self-sufficient on that. So everything was going in the right direction. The problems with Russia were diminishing because of the diversification. And the end point was not very far away where Russian gas wasn't going to be an issue anymore because it just simply wouldn't be needed. And what this war's done is just caught everybody out. It's come too early. It's come at least a decade too early. And ironically, for the Russians, they too could see this coming. And Putin was desperately trying to sign long-term gas deals in September with Merkel just to milk it for the last 10 years because the Russians themselves, their future for gas is in Asia. And 70% of the Russian delivery system comes to Europe. But they already built Paris-Siberia gas pipeline, and there's the Izo oil pipeline in the Far East. And it's going to take a decade to rebuild all the infrastructure, pointing it not west, as it is now predominantly, but east. And the Russians, too, thought they had a decade to do that. So everyone was kind of happy that, you know, we've got a decade, we'll just do some business, we'll wind down in Europe, we'll build up in Asia. And suddenly, the problem Russia faces now is it has to reorientate 70% of its export infrastructure, gas particularly, to Asia, which is going to take minimum 5 years to build the first pipeline and cost tens of billions of dollars. But Putin's clearly said, right, fine, bring it on. We're going to do that. And we'll just cut Europe off in the meantime. And they're going to have a hellish time, wreck the German business model in the meantime. And we'll cope because, you know, we'll make money anyway. We're already selling some to China. We're already selling masses of oil to China and India. We'll be okay. And we don't mind suffering. And I think that's a key point, too, to understand Putin's mindset, that he doesn't mind suffering, that it's not about economic prosperity. In the West, it's about economic prosperity, you know, freedom, happiness, the individual. And in the East, it's about security. It's about, you know, being in charge, Putin not being told what to do. And if the people suffer, so be it. If the people's incomes go down, so be it, as long as we have our security. And that's actually a mindset that's going to be really hard to fight. And actually, the polls, the stuff you're hearing coming out of Moscow, the Russians are on board with that. They're like, yeah, we can suffer. Because what do Russians do? They've been suffering for, what, their entire history. This is Putin's leverage over the West, is that he can inflict suffering on the populations. And that's going to be a huge political problem for the Western leaders to deal with.
I was thinking of another BNE article showing that tons of money, to my layperson's eyes, are coming into Russia. Like, the Russian account is bigger than it's ever been before, the Russian cash reserves. I mean, how could they not have planned for that?
Current account surplus, yeah.
Well, look, there's another. With the sanctions, again, I don't think they've been thought through very well. That it's been done on the basis of what does Russia have? What can we attack? Rather than what are the consequences of that? Mm-hmm. And specifically, the sanctions that have worked, that are incredibly effective, have been all of the bans on export of technology, equipment, all those things. And that's, I don't know, 97% effective. It's just not getting through. Russia can't buy it. They can't even buy the Chinese-produced versions because of the licensing, and the Chinese won't sell it because of, they'll get cut off themselves. And that has really the most powerful consequences on Russia because it delegates it to a second-tier sort of emerging market where it can't have modern tech. And so it doesn't have, it can never compete. It can never have productivity. So long-term, Russia is doomed to stagnate and fall slowly behind the rest of the world. And the economy's already gone in terms of size of GDP from, I think at its peak in pre-2008 crisis, it was the fourth biggest economy in the world. And it's gone down to sixth. And I saw recently it's now down to 11. And it'll keep falling down the rankings. And there's nothing Russia can do about that. I mean, all they can do is hope that the Indians and the Chinese develop equivalent technology. But again, you know, you're talking a decade or so until that even begins to happen. The energy sanctions are something entirely else because everyone focused on that because it makes such a huge part of Russia's budget. And they're like, right, Russia makes all this money from exporting oil to us in the West, so let's just cut that off. And then Russia's got no money and it'll be in real trouble. And what they didn't think through, and we said this from the very beginning,
in March,
we were saying from the very beginning that sanctions will leak. There will be significant leakage, particularly on the energy and commodities. And the question is, how significant will that be? How will that play out? When they started hitting oil and the self-sanctioning was immediate, even before the seventh package, which is due now, where they're going to do like formal oil sanctions, the traders just stopped doing business with Russia. The spread between the Urals brand of, you know, Russia's oil versus Brent went from $2 to $30. But more than that, the traders stopped buying it. They would buy everything else first. And so Russia's storage facilities were literally overflowing with oil because they couldn't get rid of it. But then, and that hurt the budget, that hurt revenues. But then 2 months into the game, market did its thing. And the Indians were like, what, everyone else is paying 120 bucks and we can buy it for 70? So bring that on.
Right.
And the Chinese were like, yeah, we'll do the same. Wow. And now
that's why
China
their inflation
and India,
rates are lower than the rest of the world, right?
And the point about the leakage is significant. It just came out today that the Middle East, that they've been doing the same thing. They've got refineries and, you know, everyone's like, I can buy oil at a 50-buck discount on 120 bucks, 110 bucks, which is insane. So the refinery margins are just like through the roof. And the upshot of this is that the sanctions were designed to get to prevent Russia making money from its oil business. And the last month, Russia made more money from oil. The current account surplus is the biggest it's ever been on record, despite the fact oil prices are not at the all-time peak, because you've got this multiplier effect of the collapsed imports, those effective sanctions of the technology. And so you've got 75% of the income comes from the boosted oil prices, but then it gets multiplied by the 25% collapse in imports. And so the sanction regime we actually impose is self-defeating. By sanctioning all those equipment imports, we actually make it easier for Russia to make money. And so that they're making more money than they've ever made before.
Can I ask you a dumb question? What can Russia, so it has this giant account surplus. What does it do with all those billions of dollars more than it used to have?
There's a joke going around that the only thing that Russia can import at the moment is money. And it's importing money in spades and it can't spend it. That's a problem, because it can't buy anything. It can't import all the things it needs. And in that sense, the sanctions are mixed. So the energy sanctions have failed. Russia's making loads of money. But then the June industrial production numbers just came out. And Russia's automotive production fell by 97% in June.
Yeah.
It's basically serious. Completely collapsed.
Yeah.
Because of components from the West that it can't get?
Exactly. Mm. 60% of the inputs. And Russia's been trying to localize and trying to get the majors to build. And they've actually refused to do it because they wanted to keep some sort of control. And this is the result, the Russia automotive sector. So you've got cities like Nizhny Novgorod, where the gas factory is screwed. The entire city is dependent on that factory. It employs hundreds of thousands of people. And they're all still on the payroll currently. They're still being paid at the moment. And the Kremlin is scratching his head with the Avtovaz. Tolyatti is another city that's screwed. That Renault Nissan took over the Avtovaz plant, the one that makes the Lada. They sold it to the state for it to the state for a ruble. And they're going to bring in Kamaz, which is a famous truck maker, and the Chinese to relaunch the Moskvich, an old Soviet car based on tiny Chinese technology. But we talked to them. And they're like, right, we've got a plan and everyone's bigging it up and nothing's happened. Absolutely nothing's happened. There's no designer, there's no director. And the Americans just sanctioned Kamaz, which was going to bring some of the technology. So that one's dead in the water too. So when you drill into the whole sanctions regimes, it's a mixed picture. And you've got, it's like weird because Russia's earning masses of money from oil and gas, but it can't spend it. And then big sectors like automotive have effectively totally shut down while they try and work out how to resuscitate them. And they've already started making the Kalina, which is the successor to the Lada, with no airbags, with no inboard computer. You know, they're just sort of cutting out all the bits they can't import and trying to get a car on the road that people can drive. So.
Wow.
It's confusing.
Can they use that money, those massive reserves that are sitting, can they use it, for example, to buy up, electronics on the black markets at a markup? Or can they use that to these are, again, dumb questions, but like you have all this money sitting somewheres. Can you use it to fund, the military machine? Can you pour any of that back into funding contractors? Like, what can
frank,
you do with that money?
I'm still grappling, trying to get my head around it. I really don't know what's going to come. that huge forces have been unleashed here. And like I say, with the oil in the early days, it looked like it was working, that Russia exports collapsed and the traders wouldn't buy Russian oil and the spread on the Urals went out to $30. But then give the market 2 months and everyone started buying those commodities and suddenly it's not a problem anymore. Russia's still selling it at a discount, but the discount's down to $15 now and so everyone's happy. And if you're talking about tech, that's the really difficult problem. Mm-hmm. That's going to be really hard to solve. And Nabulina, the central bank governor, already said, I think in early March, I mean, she gets it. She said, like, everybody's going to have to recalibrate and you're going to actually have to go back 2 generations of technology and buy that and retool with that 2 generations back in order that you can function.
Yeah.
That's pretty serious.
Well, you mentioned India a couple of times. I gather that China is sort of meshed in with the world high-tech industry too much to break the sanctions. But what about India? I know my brother goes to Bangalore a lot, and he says they're really good there. But does that matter?
We did a big piece on sanctions about a year ago in July 2021 saying, look, you know, you're talking about all these sanctions. The thing to go after is equipment. That's Russia's soft underbelly. And so it looks prophetic now. And Russia has already been busily trying to diversify its technology and invest and buy elsewhere. And India and China are both big exporters of tech to Russia. But the problem is that it's all low-grade tech or middle-grade tech. And the high-grade tech is Japan and Germany.
Oh, okay.
Even America imports German tech. The equipment, the machinery, the really, really good stuff, the stuff you really want to have, the stuff that's a game-changer for business.
Yeah.
It is those. And they're just unavailable. And there's this four-dimensional machine precision tool-making thing. I forget its name. And it can make anything. It's really cool. It's super cool. But when you buy one of those, because it could be used to make military stuff too, it comes with a lot of restrictions, but hardwired into it. And if you try and make it do other stuff, if you try and move it, it turns itself off. And you can't turn it back on again. Technological sanctions are very effective and they're enforceable. Everything else isn't. And the leakage is significant. And so the technology imports to Russia leakage, I mean, it's limited. And yes, there will be cheating, there will be black market stuff. But actually, that one is pretty easy to enforce. And I think there's going to be a serious problem. And Russia has no choice other than to try and develop itself, and it's been spectacularly unsuccessful at every attempt to do that, or is going to buy it from India and China, where there's more hope.
So everyone's basically going to be dragged down. I mean, and we haven't even talked about what's going on in the Global South yet at all. But before we get to that, in places like Africa, where your publication has started really reporting from as well.
Yeah, we expanded. We cover the whole of Africa now as well.
That's great. Congratulations on that, by the way. Real quickly, before we leave this area, there was just a tweet put out, a notification put out by Gazprom about this. And maybe you can explain this story. I was following it a bit. This turbine that's needed, I think, for Nord Stream 1. It says, Gazprom does not possess any documents that would enable Siemens to get the gas turbine engine for the Portovaya CS out of Canada, where that engine is currently undergoing repairs. I mean, so basically Gazprom is saying it's not happening. Can you tell our listeners what the story with that is?
The West has hit Russia with very painful sanctions and seized $300 billion worth of its money and not giving it back. And the West has been assuming that they can inflict all this economic pain on Russia without any cost. And what Putin's done is he's turned around and said, all right, you're talking about sanctioning our energy, you're talking about inflicting all this pain on you, well, back at you. And in the middle of June, Gazprom reduced the gas flows to the West by 60%. And particularly, as we said already, the German economy is particularly dependent on Russian gas. They have no alternative. They cannot replace that. LNG is not an option. It's only 15% of Europe supplies LNG, and it's maxed out already. And if you turn the gas off, in Europe, then everybody's going to be affected, Germany most of all, that you simply won't be able to get through the winter without a massive energy crisis that will knock on to an economic crisis. So when Gazprom reduced the flows by 60%, the reason it did that, it said the compressor was broken and had been sent to Canada to be fixed. And then they couldn't get it back because of sanctions. The Siemens wouldn't send it back because of sanctions. And so Gazprom was like, right, we'll just reduce the gas. And now the EU is backtracked. And I think it was yesterday, they certified and said that this compressor can be sent back to Russia so that they can
It's an anti-Russian compressor, so it qualifies, right?
And it makes the point very nicely that the sanctions, they're not laws.
Right.
They're
right.
Whatever we want them to be, that, right. You know, they're weapons. And suddenly right. Europe realized that we screwed up by not letting this compressor go back. Suddenly Germany's facing a freezing cold winter with no heating. Right. And so, we'll just sign this paper and we'll send it back. But the Russians came back just today, like you said, saying, well, we haven't got a piece of paper, so we're not getting it, you know, so we'll just leave the gas off. Okay, guys? You'll be good that way.
Right.
This would really cure you of any idea that the elites have some special knowledge or even elementary sense.
Have it all worked out. Yeah. I know.
Which elites?
Well,
ours or theirs?
I know. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I would say both at this point. I think the invasion was a dumb idea, and I think the response to the invasion has been, by this account, pretty
poorly thought through.
I think on our side, increasingly it seems to me that just rushing into it and saying, like, where does Russia make most of its money? Oil and gas. Oh, let's hit that. I mean, look, we'll take the issue of the oil price caps. So because Russia's making all this insane amount of money, the plan is now that they were trying to do at the G7 meeting just gone and failed to get anywhere with it because it turns out it's fantastically complicated to organize. But the plan is to simply ignore the market and not pay $120 for oil or $100 as it is now, just to pay Russia's production cost plus 10%. So that means the Russian companies can continue to operate and supply us oil, and then we'll just buy it at a price that screws the Russian budget, and we'll just dictate the price. This is the plan. And the way you're going to enforce that is that 95% of the ship insurance is done basically in London at Lloyd's. And so you can say to any ship that's going to carry oil, because we turn the pipelines off, put it all on ships, you just say to any ships can carry oil, like, we won't give you insurance unless you do a contract price at, say, $60 for Russian oil. And they think this is going to work. And it's not, again, because of the leakage that the Russians, the Indians have already, you need safety certificates. And so the international body has refused to certify Russian ships, except the Indian subbody within this international body that gives these safety certifications, which you need for insurance. That's just certified the entire Russian fleet of oil tankers, Sovcomflot, and has completely blown that particular sanction out of the water. So this attempt, this enforcement mechanism that the West is intending to use to enforce these oil caps, it's just not going to work. Because the Russians will just ignore the London Lloyd's-based insurance business. And they'll get the certificates. They've already got the certificates to get the insurance. And they'll get the insurance from Chinese companies, from Indian companies, from their own companies. And just simply not sell any oil to the West if they insist on this price cap. And this is going to... We've got to a point, I think, where all of the one-way sanctions that I was talking about in the beginning have ended. That now we have two-way sanctions, which means that the West is going to have to take significant pain and say, okay, we won't buy Russian oil, we won't buy Russian gas, but that means that we're going to have to ration energy in Germany this winter. We're going to have to tell the factories to work at 50%. We're going to have to make sure that hospitals and homes of pensioners get heating, and everyone else is going to have to turn the thermostat down by 10, 15 degrees and see a huge recession.
One of the strangest things about this is that this is a U.S.-led coalition, but as far as I can tell, which admittedly isn't very far, as you say, this falls very disproportionately on Central Europe and not on the U.S. at all.
We should say specifically that this is not a global conflict. This is specifically the G7 plus a couple of other countries versus Russia. And that's one of the big tectonic forces that have been unleashed that I simply have no idea where this is going. We're working very hard to try and understand it because the whole global South, you know, from the whole of Asia through Africa into Latin America, they're not on board with this. They want no part of it. They're not going to enforce sanctions. They're not going to support the G7. This is specifically G7 led by the States versus Russia. And that's Putin's big bet. It's like, you know, we're an emerging market. We already have good relationships all across Asia. We have good relationships in Africa. So our news service there has been very timely because we're seeing a lot of stories come up. And moreover, we have good relationships in South America. Ironically, the whole coronavirus, where there was this vaccine apartheid and the Western world kept its vaccines to itself, Russians went out of their way, flooded South America with Sputnik V, and have earned a lot of goodwill there. And now they're going to cash all of that in. And Putin's betting that, all right, we won't have the technology from the West, so we will go slower than them. But I'm going to build a non-aligned, non-G7, other world, second world, parallel world, where we all do business with each other. And our advantage over the West is babies. We have all the growing populations. We have all the growth in the emerging markets. And what we lack in technology, we'll make up for with population growth, with consumption, domestic consumption. And if you look at it in those terms, it's actually not that bad a bet because that's where the world's going to all these markets. And the key signpost along this road is going to be the G20 summit in November in Indonesia, which will be, I think, Putin's first big outing, you know, in this new global South world that he's looking to. And God knows how that's going to go. I mean, I think this is now going to keep us busy for the next decade.
Oh, yeah. It seems like, I mean, just from reading too many science fiction novels, it sounds like the unintended consequences could get very dramatic like that, since educated labor tends to follow the money. If Europe becomes deindustrialized and impoverished and Russia can buy stuff from India and China, then it seems like a...
The emerging markets have been empowered, the catalyst here, because, I mean, until now, emerging markets has just been sort of an asset class invented by Jim O'Neill at Goldman Sachs, the BRICS, you know, where you can make loads of money, 1,000% return in a year if you get the timing right. And suddenly now they've become this huge political thing, this geopolitical thing that you've got Biden who's just turned up in the Middle East to shore up his relationships with them because the Russians are down there too. And everybody's starting to run around the world. You've got Scholz was in Africa last month, again, looking for energy deals. Nigeria is talking about building a gas pipeline through Algeria into southern Europe. That's been talked about for 20 years, but will probably appear next year. So the whole emerging markets, I think, are being catalyzed. And suddenly you've got these big, powerful countries who are just going to pay them a lot more attention because before they were just sources of profit and cheap labor. And suddenly now they need them as allies. And they're going
to
milk
I mean, I would imagine, I would imagine to a lot of regimes and people in power in many, many countries, seeing the West led by the U.S., first and foremost, just taking $350 billion in central bank reserves, not to mention all the other stuff. I mean, that must be unsettling. If you don't feel that visceral fear and horror of the Russian invasion the way that the Europeans who live close to Ukraine might feel, you might feel much more the threat of, wow, that is a real global power. We need to protect ourselves because anytime it's kind of like we played our big card.
Think of what this looks like to you know, the Middle East or Africa or particularly Asia, which is next up. I mean, the Americans have said they're coming for China.
Yeah.
And think, yeah. you know, the Americans just weaponized the dollar and they weaponized trade. And yeah. you're sitting in Indonesia or India or Vietnam or particularly Vietnam and looking at that and like, right, I could get cut off from chips, from all these factories I've been building to make cars and computers and, you know, wide flat screen TVs. And I could just lose all of that. And so there's going to be a mad scramble.
Or if I hold too many treasuries, right, I could lose that. I mean,
No, I mean, the consequences of what's happened, like I said, and this is why I really throw my hands up. I'm like, I can't make predictions. I really don't know what's going to happen because the huge tectonic forces have been unleashed with a short-term goal of crushing or destroying or wounding the Russian economy. But the long-term consequences are going to be really significant. And I think now, this is why I'm pointing to the emerging markets as saying that they're suddenly in a really interesting place. And that lots of money and effort and attention is going to be thrown at them. And this, and they're actually largely on board in general terms with Putin's objection to the G7. And now the G7 has just shown itself, you know, it'll come at you with a big stick if it feels like it. And the rest of the emerging world are going to be very unsettled by that. And so that's just going to bolster things like the G20, which is why I'm saying the G20 in Indonesia this November is going to be so interesting to see how that plays out, how the relationships are, you know, who stands next to Putin in the photo op. You know, because we're in a whole new world. I mean, 30 years covering Russia, suddenly everything is different, everything has changed, and God knows where we're going next.
I mean, I remember there's a line attributed to Stalin. I can't verify that he really said it, but that Hitler was doomed because the only thing he understood was Europe. And it's like, you know, a lot of people on both sides, I think, only understood Europe plus the U.S., that world.
Well, you look at the coverage. It's the English language, you know. Yeah. It's very Europe-centric. Yep. It's very Ukraine-centric. The fact that the Indonesian president attended the G7 meeting just in that just was in Germany, in Bavaria, was barely reported. And, you know, I've been covering Russia for almost 30 years. And in all that time, I've heard Indonesia mentioned in context with Russia never.
I know.
Never.
I know. That's pretty wild. Yeah. And now suddenly it's really meaningful, isn't it? Yeah. I have two more questions, two quick ones that I really want to get in with Ben, if you don't mind, because we have him here. One concerns Russia and Kazakhstan. There seemed to be like a rift opening up between them, and it seems that maybe Russia is doing something very stupid with Kazakhstan. So I wanted to find out to see what Ben, what you know about this. And the other question has to do with Ukraine's budget and economy, because we talk about how the economic war and the war is affecting Russia and how it's affecting the West and the global South, but, you know, it's destroying Ukraine. And so you can answer either one or both of those questions.
Let's deal with Kazakhstan first. It's actually extremely interesting in so much as it's a case study in what I've been talking about, these changing relationships. And Tokayev, the new president, he sat on stage with Putin in St. Petersburg, and he said to his face, we don't recognize the independence of Donetsk and Lugansk, which was a slap in the face for Putin. And this is the problem all of the other emerging markets will have, is that on the one hand, they're with Putin in so much as they're uneasy about the West, they're unsettled by the weaponization of dollar and Western trade. Mm-hmm. And they support Russia. Again, we did a big piece about the UN votes to condemn Russia for the invasion, and they show very clearly that a lot of people were sitting on the fence, but they still are very aware of the fact that they need to keep good relationships with the West. And so I think with that statement, Tokayev was saying to the West, look, we're not lapdogs to the Russians. We have our own agenda. We are open to dialogue with you, partners, and we're not just going to toe the Russian line. But at the same time, he's saying to Putin, like, you know, you are our most important key investor, trade partner, etc. And so he gives him a slap in the face, but then afterwards in an interview with the Russian press, he said, no, Russia remains extremely important and is our best and closest ally. And I think the Putin has to be pragmatic enough to realize everyone's going to play this game to some extent. So it's not like he's going to build, it's not like we're going to go back to the Cold War, we're going to have two camps, you know, left and right, communist and capitalist. That everyone in the global south is going to toe their own interests, play their own game. But then you look at the Indians, who definitely fence-sat through this whole thing. But when it came down to commerce, have completely thrown themselves to support the Russian oil industry to the point where they've undermined sanctions by certifying all these ships. And I think we're going to see everyone do the same thing. And I think actually Putin's completely happy with that. I think that's what he thinks a multipolar world looks like. As long as you don't toe the American line and impose their sanctions on us and enforce them, you know, just do business in your own interests. So Kazakhstan, that was an interesting, quite delicate dance that I think everyone's going to have to do. And the Uzbeks are the same. The Ukrainian budget thing, that's a fascinating one because, you know, although, again, if you read the press and watch the reports, we're a gung-ho fully behind heroic Ukraine, who's been standing up to the evil Russian giant bear with spectacular success. And we've been sending loads and loads and billions of dollars worth of arms. But actually, when you start to drill into it, the arms deliveries have been less than spectacular, although effective. And I think the way to understand this is the West's attitude to Ukraine has been just enough. That we're sending just enough money, just enough arms, so that Russians don't roll over them. And real game changers, like tanks, like fighter planes, like bombers, like closing the Ukraine sky. None of that has been done. Stuff that really would allow the Ukrainians to turn this fight around has not been delivered. The HIMARS, the missile system that's just arrived, has been incredibly effective, but there's six of them. Right. You know, and then they're talking about another 2 months, there might be another nine. And these are not game changers against the press of the Russian army and the insistent and incessant artillery shelling. And nowhere is this clearer than in the support of the budget. That Ukraine is burning through $8 billion a month. And to put that into context, the whole IMF program last year for 18 months was for $5 billion of support for a year and a half. And Ukraine's burning through $8 billion and revenues, tax revenues have collapsed by 80% and their exports have been totally cut off. So they're not making any money. They're running a deficit $4 to $5 billion a month. And the way they're paying for it at the moment is the central bank is simply printing money. So this is not going to last. You know, we're headed towards a major economic crisis.
Right.
And they've been calling on the West to give them money. But since the war, in 4 months, the West has sent a total of $8.6 billion. It's peanuts.
That, you know, Andrew Coburn, who's been on our show, is Harper's editor in D.C. He just sent out a newsletter. And I think his basic point was most of that $53 billion package wound up in North Virginia mansions. I mean, it's just, you know, that money is mostly staying in North Virginia and a few.
A huge share of it goes, the U.S. allocations, a huge share of it just simply goes to U.S. arms producers to pay for weapons. Yeah. None of it goes to Ukraine. And they need cash. And we're actually getting to the point now where it's starting to show. So there's a black market rate for the hryvnia again, which we haven't seen since the 90s.
Oh, I see.
The exchange rate is separated between the official rate and what people actually pay for on the street. Mm-hmm. And Naftogaz, the state gas company, has just asked bonds. It's $1.4 billion bond holders. It asked them yesterday if they wouldn't mind if it didn't pay the coupons because Ukraine has only 20% of its tanks full ahead of winter. It needs to buy 5 billion cubic meters of gas before the heating season starts in 3 months' time, which will cost $7.8 billion to pay for that gas. At a time when everybody else in Europe is desperately trying to fill their tanks. So I don't even think that gas is available to buy. And it certainly doesn't have the money to buy it because Naftogaz has a working flow of about $2 billion. So I don't know where they're going to get the money from. And on top of this, The US and Europe are both supposed to send around $9 billion, it's $18 billion in total, to specifically support the budget. But both those, the Germans have blocked the European one because they have to underwrite it. And they're not happy about being responsible for that because it's going as a loan, not a grant. And the Americans yesterday also have tangled their loan up in red tape because they're worried about accountability. And so our side is saying to Ukrainians, basically, we don't trust you, that if we send this money, it's going to get stolen, so we're not going to send it. So we'd rather do that and leave Ukraine to print money like there's no tomorrow and have an economic crisis there than we are to do helicopter money and just drop, you know, $20 billion on them. Here's a bunch of money. Get on with it. Win the war. You know, so I think the whole, when you actually dig into it, the whole attitude is just enough. We'll do just enough to bail out. I don't think there will be an economic crisis because just enough money will be given to stop that from happening, from, you know, a collapse, a budget crisis, a balance of payment crisis. And the goal here is simply not to allow Ukraine to win, but to make sure that Russia doesn't win. That's the
right. To bleed them.
Bleed them. Yeah. Well, that's all pretty depressing, which would be standard for Radio Warner. But, you know, I mean, it's just pain and misery all around. In the home countries, and Russia's got a bleak future. Ukraine has a bleak future.
We haven't even talked about stagflation. And that's going to be the big consequence of all of this. We're going into stagflation, and all of us have a very miserable several years going ahead with unemployment and social problems and food riots in Africa. This is not, we're not in a good place.
I think this is one of the things Putin was sort of, I don't see him as this like super genius Captain Chaos and so on, but I think this was a calculation he made that has turned out after the first couple months to be truer than the other side, which is that this is going to cause much worse subversion. I mean, really, for the West, which has the most to lose, because we're the rich, we live on the rich block, you know, we're the rich people. And so the subversion is real.
For me, it's a West intolerance to suffer pain. The Russians don't care. Yes. And that's his ace. Russians will take a lot more pain and stagflation and economic slowdown and all that stuff. He doesn't care. And we do. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to be able to bear it, particularly if, you know, I mean, look at Biden. He's going into elections next year, and any president that's been residing over a recession has lost. And that's almost certainly what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's going to be brutal, November and every other election. It's going to be rough. Yeah, I agree. I think on that miserable note, I think we can end our interview with Ben Aris, founding editor of BNE IntelliNews. We'll post links also. Thank you again so much, Ben, for coming back on the show and updating us on the economic war side of the Ukraine-Russia war.
Great pleasure, Mark. Very nice to be here again. Thank you very much.
thanks, Ben. It was great. Yeah. I actually finally understood some of this. Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Okay, all the best, guys.
Thanks, Ben. Okay, that was our talk with Ben Aris, founding editor of BNE IntelliNews. I'll post his Twitter feed and links to his excellent business and economics news site. And I think that's it, John. I think we'll wrap up here. Thanks again, everyone. And
thanks, everybody.
Talk to you again soon.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.